Hello, I'm John Hilton, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit. Welcome to the March 2011 roundup from the Cochrane Library. At thecochranelibrary.com this month, you'll find 29 new and 49 freshly updated Cochrane reviews, as well as three new editorials. These include the thoughts of Professor David Stott from the Cochrane Healthcare of Older People field and Dr. Helen Handel from the Cochrane Bone, Joint and Muscle Trauma Group on key messages from Cochrane reviews of rehabilitation of older people who have had a hip fracture, while Carrie-Ann Hammerstrom and Arild Bjørndal, who are based in Oslo, Norway, with the Campbell Collaboration, debate the question, if there are no randomised controlled trials, do we always need more research, taking Cochrane reviews on Laetril, homeopathy and MMR vaccinations as examples. In our third editorial, Vikas Sood and colleagues from the South Asian Cochrane Centre, the Pakistan Medical Association and the Indian Forum for Medical Students Research describe the creation and growth of the Cochrane Students Journal Club, a collaborative venture that is encouraging medical students to get involved in research, and, in keeping with one of the Cochrane Collaboration's core principles, builds on the enthusiasm of individuals. People throughout the Cochrane Collaboration have been shocked by the terrible scenes from Japan, and feel great sympathy and solidarity with those who have been affected so badly. Given the catastrophic consequences of the earthquake and tsunami, we have reinstated special collections on earthquakes and flooding, and will also publish a special collection on the psychological consequences of major life events. In addition, our publishers, John Wiley, have arranged for free access to the Cochrane Library to be made available to those in the affected region as part of our Evidence Aid programme. You can access the special collections and find out more about the programme at www.evidenceaid.org. This month's CochraneLibrary.com also contains a new special collection for World Kidney Day, which this year has the theme Protect Your Kidneys, Save Your Heart. The Cochrane Renal Group, based in Sydney, Australia, has selected several recent Cochrane reviews that demonstrate the connection between the heart and the kidneys. These reviews provide information to help consumers, clinicians and policymakers in their efforts to prevent severe chronic kidney disease, and evidence on the effects of interventions that should improve the quality of life of people who develop this condition. And now to this month's new and updated Cochrane reviews. The Cochrane Skin Group produces large, comprehensive reviews covering many interventions for specific conditions. Ben Carter from the Department of Public Health, Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of Birmingham in England describes what they found in updating the review for rosacea, a common skin condition in young people.
Rosacea is a common skin condition affecting the face, characterized by flushing, redness, pimples, pustules, and diluted blood vessels. It usually appears before the age of 30, and up to 10% of the population are affected to varying degrees. The latest version of the Cochrane review shows that there are some effective treatments. There are four subtypes of rosacea and one variant, and patients can suffer from more than one at the same time. This might mean they need a combination of treatments. Up to 60% of rosacea sufferers have subtype 4, which involves the eye or eyelids. As with most chronic skin diseases, treatment of rosacea is not intended to cure, but to ease the symptoms. The persistent red pimply rash on the face can cause embarrassment, anxiety, low self-esteem, and lack of confidence. For some patients, it leads to depression and social anxiety disorder. This makes the effect of treatment on a patient's quality of life an important part of the assessment of any intervention. The review was last updated in 2005. Since then, interest in the pathogenesis and treatment of rosacea has continued to grow, and the authors knew of several new studies before they started the update. By the time they had finished, the number of trials in the review had doubled, but some areas remain under-researched. The Cochrane researchers had hoped to find more randomised trials of some widely used pharmacological treatments, such as tetracycline, doxycycline, minocycline, and azithromycin, and some other common treatments, like topical and systemic retinoids and light-based therapies. There also continues to be a lack of suitable studies for other approaches recommended by dermatologists, including the avoidance of triggers using sunscreens and dietary advice. Turning to the evidence base in the review, most of the studies had a high or unclear risk of bias. However, the findings from the earlier versions of this review that topical metronidazole and topical azelaic acid, as well as oral tetracycline, were effective for papulopustular rosacea remained solid. One of the new findings, and something that might make another valuable contribution for the treatment of this kind of rosacea, is the use of an anti-inflammatory sub-antimicrobial dose of 40 mg doxycycline. This was shown to be effective and safe, and this low dose of 40 mg appears to be as effective as a higher dose of 100 mg, but with only a quarter of the side effects. Another new finding is that cyclosporine 0.5% ophthalmic emulsion appears to be more effective than artificial tears for rosacea of the eyes. Many gaps still remain, though, as well as the need for more research into the interventions I mentioned earlier. Most of the studies done to date were for patients with papulopustular rosacea. Well-designed trials are needed for the other subtypes, since all these can be debilitating and may have a serious impact on a person's quality of life.
Further details of the treatments and the studies in this review can be found at thecochranelibrary.com. And you can also hear other members of the author team describe their findings in Dutch, Hindi and Spanish at www.cochrane.org/podcasts. Our second featured review tackles the provision of palliative care in care homes for older people. This is one of those reviews that takes on a common problem, but finds that the evidence base is very thin. Sue Hall from King's College London in England discusses the findings and some solutions.
We embarked on this review because the number of older people who die in care homes is increasing. More people are living longer, but this often means that they live with illnesses and disabilities, such as dementia, heart disease and arthritis, and need to move into care homes towards the end of life. We wanted to investigate the effectiveness of the palliative care interventions they might receive, and look specifically at palliative care service delivery interventions. Palliative care provides relief from pain and other distressing symptoms experienced by people reaching the end of life. It helps people live as actively as possible until death, and their families cope with illness and bereavement. These are complex, multi-component interventions which usually include the assessment and management of residents' physical, psychological and spiritual symptoms and advanced care planning. End-of-life care in care homes for older people may differ from palliative care more generally, which was developed to reduce the suffering of people with advanced cancer. Care home residents usually have more than one disease. Their death may seem more natural than the life cut short, and they are more likely to have cognitive impairment, making it particularly difficult to assess and manage their symptoms. We expected that there will be few randomised trials, so we decided to include other relatively high quality study designs, such as controlled before and after studies. We also needed to use a broad search strategy to find the palliative care interventions. There's no short search and shortcut for the variety of interventions we were interested in. With such a broad search, going through everything we found was particularly time consuming. For example, at least two people checked through the titles of each of nearly 15,000 articles. We eventually arrived at three studies that we were able to include in the review. All three were conducted in the United States, but the differences between them were so great that we did not do a meta-analysis. Instead, we summarised the results of each trial separately. All three studies reported some positive effects of palliative care interventions in care homes for older people, but all had some risk of bias. Two studies looked at the actual outcomes that were important to the residents, such as reduced pain or increased quality of life. One study found higher family satisfaction with end-of-life care in a small group of 17 residents who had died during the study period. Another found decreased discomfort in residents with advanced dementia. Two studies reported improvements on process measures of healthcare, which assessed the procedures done when providing care, such as advanced care planning discussions or pain assessment. They found increased enrolment into hospice, more do not resuscitate orders and documentation of advanced care plans, and fewer hospital admissions and days in hospital. However, we do not know if these led to improvements in outcomes for the residents. Our review highlights the shortage of good quality research in this area. This is not restricted to care home settings. Reviews of specialised palliative care have also found that the evidence base is sparse and limited by methodological shortcuttings. The better news is that some high quality studies are underway, and these improvements need to be extended into care home settings. We don't know why there were no high quality studies outside the USA. Perhaps more funding is available for such studies there. Although there are challenges to conducting high-quality research in care homes, our review shows that it can be done. In our own experience of a recently completed pilot randomised trial conducted in the United Kingdom, we've shown that care home staff were generally very enthusiastic and helpful. The number of older people living and dying in care homes will increase. We need to find cost-effective ways of improving their end-of-life care. Our results are encouraging. They suggest that palliative care interventions may improve end-of-life care for residents. However, there is a need for more high-quality research in this area, particularly outside the United States. This will require the development and testing and implementation of agreed outcome measures across the studies. Existing measures, such as the palliative care outcome scale, could be adapted for care homes, and also for research funders to support high-quality studies in this area.
You can read more about the interventions evaluated by Sue and her colleagues at thecochranelibrary.com. We end this month by returning to the beginning. We end this month by returning to the beginning. The new editorial on another common serious problem, hip fractures in older people, accompanies a newly updated Cochrane review of mobilisation strategies. Ginny Hetherington from the Cochrane Collaboration Secretariat describes how it fits within a collection of related reviews.
Hip fracture, which is a break in the top part of the thigh bone, is a major health problem in older age. It has been a common fracture for some time, but its incidence is escalating as the population ages in many countries around the world. Most hip fractures occur in older people, many of whom are already frail. Although surgical treatment is generally successful, few people recover fully from their hip fracture. Around a third of people die within a year, often because of their fracture. Most survivors experience a marked decline in their physical function. For instance, they do not walk as well as before and become more dependent on help from others. For some, the fracture will mean that they're not able to look after themselves as well as before, and they might need to be admitted to a nursing home. The updated Cochrane Review is one of a series of complementary systematic reviews in the Cochrane Library that, taken together, address a wide range of rehabilitation issues after hip fracture. This includes reviews on multidisciplinary rehabilitation, interventions targeting physical and psychosocial function, nutritional supplementation, and, in the most recent update, mobilisation strategies. This review examines the evidence on interventions that try to help achieve a key aim of care after surgery, getting people safely back on their feet and walking again. Various strategies to improve mobility, such as exercise programs, are used during hospital stay and often after discharge from hospital. The updated review presents the current state of the evidence from randomized trials for interventions used for improving mobility at various stages after hip fracture surgery. It includes evidence from 19 trials involving nearly 1,600 people who were generally aged 65 or over. 12 trials tested interventions started shortly after hip fracture surgery and in hospital, such as walking soon after treatment, weight-bearing programs, physiotherapy, resistance training, gait retraining, and muscle strengthening. The other 7 trials looked at different types and durations of training and exercise programs started at different times after the person had left hospital. No 2 trials were sufficiently alike to pull their findings, especially in terms of the interventions being tested. This meant that the review could not draw strong conclusions on the use of the specific interventions or strategies that had been tested in the trials. However, the authors of the review were able to conclude that the trials generally indicate that it is possible to enhance mobility after hip fracture. In particular, they note that the most successful programs evaluated to date had involved more intensive ongoing exercise. The findings of this Cochrane review, like others in this field, may seem disappointing, with the all-too-familiar conclusion of insufficient evidence to reach a firm recommendation to guide clinical practice right now. However, putting the Cochrane hip fracture reviews into the wider context of other relevant Cochrane and high-quality non-Cochrane systematic reviews, as well as evidence-based guidelines on the management and rehabilitation of other categories of older people, provides a clearer picture of how best to manage hip fracture.
You'll find more about the trials in the newly updated review, the other Cochrane reviews in this area, and the new editorial, as well as everything we've heard about this month, at thecochranelibrary.com. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening to this March roundup of the Cochrane Library.